Hello and welcome once again to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. And at the other end of the series of tubes and wires that we call the internets is Joe, Crazy Writer. How you doing today, Joe?
Okay.
Oh, that's never a good sign.
No, as we peel the covers back and reveal behind the scenes, we're actually recording this a couple days early because I was actually homesick, and which I don't want to be, because as we talked about last time, I got a hynia to take care of in a couple weeks. So using a sick day isn't the best thing I could do. But when you're sick, you're sick. As I sat around the basement and just kind of rustled about, I thought, hey, maybe we could get our podcast done today, and then Corey could have a rare Thursday off.
Except Thursday is an interview day.
That ties in perfect.
I am interviewing Nyla Rose, so by the time this episode drops, I either will have the interview up or it will be showing up on Friday. One of the two. I haven't decided. It's going to depend. Now, I'm going to do some behind-the-scenes stuff myself.
Ooh.
They only want to do it via Zoom.
Zoom, Zoom, Zoom.
Now, with Zoom, you have to buy the professional version in order to record more than 40 minutes. And that's a couple $100s.
Oof.
So what they said was, well, we do everything on Zoom. We want to keep a copy of it, so we're going to record it. We'll send you a copy. And I'm like, great. Cool. Now I don't have to buy a copy.
Now, is this video or just audio?
It will be audio, but I may put up the video on the YouTubes.
Cool.
And the audio will be available for those of you on the Crazy Comics and Stories podcast RSS feed as part of Solitaire Rose Radio. But also it will be over at PWInsiderElite.com. So we're going to be talking
podcasting tramp.
We're going to be talking wrestling. We're going to be talking X-Men. We're going to be talking, I did not know this until I did my research, that Nyla Rose actually played a nerdy IT supervisor in a Canadian comedy series. So we're going to be talking all kinds of stuff.
Cool. She's nerdy.
And I'm going to be cranking up the interviews again.
Cool.
Because the group home schedule has lightened up a little bit. Other things in my personal life have started to lighten up a bit. So I'm looking to do more interviews. So Solitaire Rose Radio will be quietly coming back. I'm not going to say how often, but I'm getting more spare time. So there's that. Solo Joe will never return, because if I say that, maybe Joe will get mad and go, yes, it will, and record some. So
no,
there will never be another solo Joe.
Whenever I retire, I'll probably get around to doing it, because I've got people I'd like to talk with as well. But unlike you, I'm not a podcasting madman. I'm an eBay guy. I like to spend my time eBaying. But who knows? Like I said, when that retirement hits, why, you know, it'd be fun. We'd go over and talk to some of the comic guys in town and, you know, if there's ever a comic show around, like I just found out, hot off the interwebs. You all know where the source is, right? Source Comics and Game,
yes,
Roseville, Minnesota. They are having an in-store signing with Benjamin Percy and Brent Schoonover
on
Wednesday, May 4th, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. I guess they have a comic book called Devil's Highway coming out. And it says, a truck stacked with bodies is discovered along the U.S.-Canadian border, and Sharon Harrell and Quentin Skinner are on the case. They need to figure out how all these corpses are connected, and when they uncover the terrifying truth, they will unearth a murder syndicate that has infiltrated the walls of the very institutions meant to protect us. Now, our heroes are on the run, hunted by law enforcement in the trucking community, framed for crimes they didn't commit. That sounds familiar. Did we review that? I don't remember.
I don't remember
anything. I mean, it would have been a previews thing, but So if you happen to be around and I'm still off Wednesdays, I may slide over there and bring my recorder. Maybe try to, first I got to find it. I might just end up buying another one. But so you got that going for you.
Which is nice.
Yep. And we like to promote our good buddies at the source.
Now, they are probably one of the shops we will stop at for our big free comic book day coming on in 2 weeks. Believe it or not, it's three weeks away.
Yep. And then what's even better is when I'm out getting my hip done, you can drop that episode. So you'll have a couple weeks to like get it ready before you have to put it up.
You're getting your hip done? I thought you were getting your hynia done.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what. I'm getting cut open again. I should just put zippers along my body, make it easier. Yeah, yank that sumbitch out.
Now, in 2 weeks, on the 30th, is Independent Bookstore Day. And Greg Ketter, damn handsome man, over at Dreamhaven Books is going to be having a big event. And I forget what's... Oh, and the 30th... marks the return of my friend Tommy and I getting together to do terrible, terrible movies. And we may actually, we're thinking of putting something out about that. Don't know what yet. We're still thinking, but we've got just stacks and stacks and stacks of terrible movies and all sorts of information. And, something may come of that. And then the next week is Free Comic Book Day.
They're actually the Minnesota Comic Book Geeks. I forget the name of. I just had it here. Hang on a second. They posted a bingo card for people visiting comic shops. So, and some of the bonus shops are like Pulp Comics down in Rochester and Granite City up in St. Cloud that we'll be visiting. So that ought to be kind of fun if you're prone to do that. Corey and I will talk off podcasts about which stores we want to hit. Every year we seem to hit the same stores. Consistency.
Dangerous Dan Moore will be at a convention.
You mean Grandpa Moore is going to a convention?
Yes.
Kids, get off of my con.
Down in Des Moines. And I have the next day off, so who knows? We may do some shenanigans.
Yep. That way he needs some shenanigans. He's like, it's only 4 hours away.
Never tempt Joe with a road trip.
Road trip. So, and then, of course, after that is Return of Microcon Comic Book Show, Saturday, May 14th at the Mermaid Entertainment and Event Center, the Atlantis Event Room up in Moundsview. So $5 to get in. I know Dan Juergens will be there. We talked to Gordon Purcell is going to be there. So that ought to be pretty fun. Big cons on the way, unfortunately, but a lot of little shows. Like this upcoming weekend, there's a Minnesota Toy Posse show that I like to go to just out at the... Well, it doesn't matter where it is. By the time you hear this, it'll be over. But they tend to do them every month, and it's always fun to go. I usually go not looking for anything, which is always great when I find things. And, of course, last time I went, I must have dropped at least 100 or so bucks on comic books. So people are knowing to bring comics.
So lots of stuff going on comic-wise for Joe and I.
Oh, yeah.
But also, we have this book that we're in love with.
Oh, absolutely. Again, we're revisiting the Overstreet Comic Book Price Guide to Lost Universes by Robert M. Overstreet, J.C. Vaughn, and Scott Braden. We should send Overstreet a note and saying, hey, we're doing a podcast on this and enjoying the book greatly, if you want to give us some bling about it.
give us some love.
But we're not getting paid for this. We just love the book, and we went through last episode, I don't know when it was, because we covered quite a bit. So right now we're in the D's for Defiant.
Yes, we ended with Cross Gen last time. Yep. We're now at Defiant. And if you're reading the book, Defiant existed for about a year.
A blink.
And it is literally makes up a quarter of the book most of the interviews, it's sort of outsized in how much it's talked about here. And there are two reasons. In the book, they said, well, because everybody involved is still alive.
Well, and so willing to talk.
A number of these other publishers. But one thing that is not talked about is that Jim Shooter, very good friends with Mr. Overstreet, very good friends with J.C. Vaughan and Scott Braden, from what I have heard, and also the owner of Mile High Comics, Chuck Rosansky, and Jim Shooter are best buds. So it's very and he was involved kind of behind the scenes with Defiant. And at the time, I remember he would take out ads for Defiant books in Comic Buyer's Guide with, oh, we've got all the Defiant books, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he had tons and tons of the back behind the scenes stuff. But Defiant was what Jim Shooter put together after he was let go from Valiant. They lasted a year. They did discover some new talent. The one who's probably the most well-known, David Lapham, who I think also worked on Valiant books, but I don't 100% remember. But David Lapham, J.G. Jones, Charlie Adlard, and Adam Polina all got their start there. He did also bring in some established creators like Len Wein, Dave Cockrum, Chris Claremont, Steve Ditko, Alan Weiss. Matter of fact, he had Steve Ditko illustrate a comic that was then cut up into trading cards. And you would buy the cards, and he had a special Warriors of Plasm like notebook with 9-card card sleeves, and as you would get the trading cards, it would be, oh, okay, this one goes here, this one goes here, this one goes here. In order to get the zero issue, you had to buy trading cards. And I remember at the time going, well, boy, I'm going to get a lot of panels I don't want, so to hell with that. Joe, this was while you had a shop.
Oh, yeah.
So, now, you were a shop that made a lot of money off Valiant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we actually came in. Groover and I both had runs of Valiant, the hot books that everybody was all excited about. So, yeah, we did pretty good with Valiant.
So, now, what Defiant, was your thought with Defiant before it came
Defiant, out? Defiant, if you remember, took us down to one of the, was it Diamond? Yeah, it must have been. No, it was at Cap City. No, it was still Cap City at the time. They took us down to a show in St. Louis. And they took us over to the East St. Louis River. I don't know what it's called. It was basically a gambling river boat. When Defiant came out, the river was flooding extremely harsh. And again, this is Mississippi we're talking. So the boat didn't actually leave the dock, but they treated it like it. They did. So if you got on the boat, if you got off, you were off for good. You didn't get to go off and on. So Defiant basically rented, I think, most of the boat, if not the entire thing, or they just paid for all of us retail. They had to just paid for all us retailers to go over, because I remember sitting there and, playing a slot machine, not understanding how are these people getting ding, 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 ding constantly. And when I peeked over, I was watching, and the boat was filled with old ladies. And what they did is every time they won something, they cashed it out. So they were constantly getting coins being played. And I said, oh, that's why it sounds like they're winning when they're not necessarily winning at all. But so it was a lot of fun. It was the first time I'd ever been to a gambling place and wandered around. You know, you realize if you went up to a table and you were going to play some video poker, they got you your drinks for free. Hey! If you tried to muscle in on the penny slots, oh, you thought the mafia was tough. Man, that old lady was playing. I mean, you're talking 16 machines, one lady playing all of them. I was like, whatever, honey. If that's all you got in your life, fine. So anyways, Defiant did schmooze us. I'm sure they gave us some exclusives. There are exclusives to this day. You can look on the eBays, something with an acetate cover. I've spent a lot of time gathering up Defiant stuff. Like you said, the binder had a unique card in it, the 9-page card that was rare. They did a Warrior Plasm set. And then there was one other card set. And I cannot see where it is in my vast accumulation of stuff. Same thing, a card set.
It was Dark Dominion.
Yes, that's what it was. Same thing. You got a special set. There was an exclusive comic. I believe the actual comic that you would be putting together as a card set was in previews, if I got that right, because that caused a big stink. Like, well, we don't get previews, and why should we buy the card set if we can just buy previews and get the comic? Thing is, if you tore the comic out of previews, you couldn't get it out in mint shape. So there was all sorts of fun stuff going on. Yeah, there it is. Birth of Defiant Universe. If you go right to page 138, there's that the exclusive he gave away. I'm just kind of looking through the different issues. And it was a Plasm promotional card, Defiant Plasm Zero bound inversion, where there's the previews on page 145. So a couple of books. So some of it is pretty pricey to find. Most of it is not. It's just, like I said, the Birth of Defiant Universe might be the most pricey thing you're going to find. I've picked up the card tin sealed for like $5. And again, I'm trying to get them all together, and I'll probably go, I did it, and then eBay it. I don't know. I don't recall how it sold. I think there were enough people interested in it. But eventually, and I don't know what – I was reading about what killed Defiant. And if I'm reading it right, it was Marvel suing them. And they ended up winning Defiant by like $300,000. But it kept – what it did is it delayed a multimillion-dollar deal with Mattel. Because, you know, they want to get – Mattel wants to get things going. They don't want to get bogged down by somebody else's lawsuit. And I think it got to the point it was so bad where the judge basically warned Marvel that if they ever use the court again as a business tool to take out the competition, there would be severe consequences. Because that's essentially what it was. Marvel just sued Defiant out of oblivion. And then they didn't, you know, a couple of deals fell through. And it sounds like Defiant had a venture capitalist partner. They're never named, so I don't know if it was a group or a single person. But when another deal came down that would have given them multi-million dollars to survive, the partner nixed it, which killed Defiant. So a lot of things were going on behind the scenes. It was always like the carrot was just there, and it never quite got captured. Sales-wise, nothing really sticks out. I mean, people were excited about it, but I think by the time they came out with the Splatterball, which there's two editions, one's worth allegedly $100, the other one's only worth $15. I think the rose was gone. There's a few books I'm not even familiar with. Like there's one, The Great Grimex, which had one issue before Defiant folded. So again, going through here, it's kind of fun, and you're like, oh, Prudence and Caution, two issues. I remember the first issue. I don't remember the other ones. So, again, there were multiple printings or Defiant rarities. You can have fun finding them all. Most of it's on the eBays if you want to pay the price. But a lot of this stuff has showed up in dollar bins over the year and have just kind of evaporated. So it might be tougher than you think to get it together.
When I look it up in the old sales figures, the first couple issues of Warriors of Plasm did okay, and then it just fell off a cliff. Because everybody forgets that Valiant did not do well at all until Wizard Magazine came into existence. And Wizard Magazine then said, these books are worth a lot of money. These books are worth a lot of money.
Excuse me while I choked. I just looked up on eBay's.
Yeah.
$350 for The Birth of Defiant Universe.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Well, whether they get it or not. So in other words, if you find one for $100 or $75, you're getting a deal. If that's what you're looking for.
But I remember this stuff kind of coming out, and a lot of people looked at the card sets and were like, yeah, I'm not even going to bother. Because this was also 1993. Image was throwing tons and tons of books out. Marvel had tripled their output since 1988. DC had upped their output. Dark Horse was doing Comics Greatest World. Valiant was doubling their output. Everybody was starting their own superhero universe. And this, sales-wise, from everything I've been able to find, just got lost. Now, what it says here, and I, forgive me, I think this is a bit biased. Marvel had a comic called Plasma in their UK line. And then Jim Shooter comes out with a book called Plasm. So Marvel says, hey, that's way too close to what we do. So he went, okay, I'll change it to Warriors of Plasm. Marvel filed a suit because really, hey, you're still using the word Plasm. We use it. Remember, this was during a time that Marvel was suing everybody. They tried to establish a legal precedent that they owned the letter X for comics. And a lot of that was Marvel was now a public company, and public companies are voracious beasts that must be fed with money. And what it says here is that they won the suit, but they paid $300,000. If you win the suit, shouldn't you at least get your legal fees paid? It sounds more like Marvel was just told to stop rather than winning. I haven't read the suit or anything. But if I would imagine if Mattel was offering a toy line, that toy, they would have gotten more than $300,000 for that toy line. What probably happened was this was some venture capitalist guy, and it says here that it was the River Group, which is a venture capital company. What a venture capital company does is they say, you come to them and you say, here's my business plan, here's my bona fides, here's what I'm going to do, and they'll go, okay, we will give you this much money to start your company. And usually it's this much money and this much time. And in your business plan, if you don't hit profit or you run out of money, they go, okay, we're done here, and walk away. And that happens all the time in Silicon Valley. It happens a lot in media. Tony Khan's father, Shad Khan, recently did it with a company called the Black News Network. He said, we're $5 million. If you don't turn a profit by the time we hit $5 million, I'm shutting it down. And then they spent the $5 million and he shut it down. Even though they said that they were about 6 months from profitability, he was like, no, it costs $5 million. That's the amount that I've said. And whenever a venture capitalist does that, the people involved will talk about the promise of the company. So we're getting one side of the story from the creative people. We're not hearing from the lawyers. We're not hearing from the business people. And usually, I would say every single company in this book that shut down their universe, they did it for one reason and one reason only. The money ran out.
Speaking of money, if you've got $500, you can find one of those Splatterball, the Skull Renders versus Sludge Maker second edition comics. Well, the first edition, which is unstamped, $500.
Now, what is the reason that book is worth so much?
Probably because they gave it away. And then when they came out with a second version, which was inside the, I might have been inside the actual binder. I don't know. But that came with a silver stamp that said second edition. And those I see going anywhere from $5 to $15 to $200, depending if it's signed or not. So again, it was probably the first ones were just given away rare. And the second ones were kind of, more common. I think the comic came in the actual binder. And again, my stuff's buried. I'll dig it up. There are misprint various editions. Like they're saying here, Good Guys number 2. Jim Shooter's editorial page did not have its traditional defiant blue background logo. And that they do interview in the back, I believe, or is it somewhere, a guy who like is collecting this stuff, like, you know, Oprah collects canned hams. And kudos to him for caring. You know, I just remember it came, it ended up in a lot of the, how would you say it, dollar bins? Did I have quarter bins back then?
No, you had a 50-cent bin. And then it became a dollar bin.
Yep. Asm Zero, that was the comic that was in the previews. And it's running about $30 if you want a copy. And then, of course, let's see. Plasm number zero. Plasm number zero. No, not Plasma Zero. Silly eBay. I'm getting a lot of the trading cards. Let's get into the comics. Yeah, I see a collector album for $1.99, but I don't see any of the actual comic. So, buyer beware. Oh, there's one. Oh, that's from somebody ripped it out of previews for $20, and you can tell by just looking at it. So, very interesting company. The trading card thing was unique, especially, you know, assemble it and do a comic. I don't recall gutting any, although it was pretty common when you got a hold of one. I'm just looking. They said there's a, still looking for the Plasm Zero. They said there's a single staple version that's tough to find, and I have not been able to find it here. But depending on how complete it is, like here's somebody, Plasm Zero, comic card album, full set, plus 4 pages of trading cards for $40. There's a Splatterball pin, which I did see a Splatterball trading tin. And again, I got this stuff lying around, so maybe someday I'll just take a picture of it all and just lay it out for fun's sakes. But reading wise, I couldn't tell you if I read any of them or not. I must have tried them at one time, but nothing really stuck with me. And if you do get the Overstreet thing, they do talk about the big crossover that everything was building towards that never quite got published, what would have happened, where things would have gone. So,
yeah, see, like very much like the plan he had with Valiant, where it all led up to Unity and then went forward from there. And I don't blame him for doing that because Unity worked. Unity really was – Unity and Wizard is where Valiant took off.
Oh, my Lord. Staple Plasm Zero staple variant, $500. So come get some. Jim Holster, by the way, starting on page 152, he's the guy who has all the stuff, and it's just fun to look at his collection. And even he's missing a few things. So you, as the time this was printed, you could go through, and who knows, you might have one of those laying around, and give him a call. I'm sure he'd trade for you.
The next is Eclipse Comics Total Eclipse.
This was in the next page, First Comics. This was the trend to take all your properties and put them together and cross them over. And it reads okay. They do a pretty good job. This is Eclipse, Total Eclipse. They do a pretty good job of putting the story together, of bringing you up to date. There's a few characters that make appearances that I kind of went, aw, like Mr. Monster was busy fighting a monster. And so when they came to pick him up, he couldn't break free. And when he finally broke free, they had gone. So you get a lot of cameos. My favorite, of course, is the tie-in with Tales of the Bean World. And if you look on page 4, Beanish, who's one of the shaman type characters in Bee World who breaks out, has a very crucial role during Total Eclipse in defeating the villain, and appears every so often on somebody's shoulder or in Miracle Man. Yes, that Miracle Man hand. And then what's fun is if you go read Tales of the Bean World, you see it from Beanish's point of view. And it was more cartoony because he lives a more simpler existence. And Larry Marger. Thank you. The creator of Bean World talks about, yeah, they were coming in and I wasn't quite sure because Bean World really exists on its own. But because Shaman, or I should say Beanish, is kind of the Shaman character of Bean World, it's not uncommon for him to have a vision and to maybe travel outside of their reality. And so I thought the crossover, it worked very well considering the character. I have read this over and over. I've enjoyed it. The only beef I have, it's very, very poor binding. It's square bound, kind of like you'd think Dark Knight, but every copy I've had, the glue will break if you carefully open it. And because you want to open it, you want to look at the art. So I pick these up whenever I find them in discount bins, mostly because when I want to read it, it's just going to crack in half. So did you ever partake in this one, Corey?
Yes, I did. And a couple of things I want to point out. First off, they hired Marv Wolfman to write this right after Wolfman had done Crisis on Infinite Earths. And I worked at Shinders when this came out. I could not give this thing away. Couldn't give it away. No one wanted it. Bill Sienkiewicz did the covers. At the time, Bill Sienkiewicz was a hot artist coming right off of Elektra Assassin. Big crossovers were huge, but Eclipse was sort of kind of an artsy publisher. Their sales were never great. They published a lot of stuff.
Destroy!
And a lot of the background of this was the stuff that they owned. Airboy. Let's see. Airboy, Sergeant Strike, New Wave, Liberty Project, Miracle Prowler.
Tales of the Bean World.
Well, they didn't own those characters. So
but they were in
just,
it.
Yeah, but they kind of came in and out.
Well, but they were in it pretty significantly.
But it was very much tied in with that Airboy story. Because it was the one.
It was Airboy villain, wasn't it?
Yep, it was an Airboy villain. The Airboy characters were in all 5 issues. But nobody cared. It was amazing. And it's a book that you kind of have to. First off, I felt you had to have all 5 issues. Because any sort of gap between them, you'd go, what the hell? And while Marv Wolfman did his best to interweave things, it got very confusing, very convoluted. Different artists drew different pages, so that was jarring as well. You'd be reading, and the art styles were so different that it was jarring when it would change from artist to artist. And in the end, like you said, the binding was terrible at the time. I don't think this did anything to... They did this in order to try and raise sales on these books. I don't think it did anything. I don't think anybody read this and went, oh, well, I've only been reading Miracle Man. I should go read Airboy. Or I've been reading Tales of the Bean World. I should read The Prowler. It just didn't work.
Yeah, there's a 5-issue series and then something called Total Eclipse, the Seraphim Object that was written by Kurt Busiek. There's also a preview ashcan type giveaway that is probably the most expensive thing. This is a buyer beware thing because you can sometimes find them cheap, Other times, like, you know, when they have Miracle Man in it, $15 up. I've been lucky finding them just in the inexpensive bins. But this thing came out in 88. So it's, you know, it's, what, 20 years old, 30 years old?
Yeah.
Not 88. Yeah, not 98. Or was it 88? I don't
remember. It was 88.
Yeah, 88. Yeah, yeah. That was right the first time. So, yeah, it was a ways. This was before I had a comic store, so I got nothing other than I was excited for it because I was big on crossover. Still am. I might be the only guy that recorded the original Love Boat going on the Robert Urich Love Boat.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it was, but not as much as you'd hope.
Next up is First Comics Crossroads, which First Comics had a better way of kind of saying that they could do this, because in the book Grimjack, there was a place called Munden's Bar, which was in Cynosure. And Cynosure is where all realities meet. And Munden's Bar was a backup in Grimjack that would other creators could bring their characters and have them show up in this city.
Also, a couple really, really cool one-shots worth picking up if you can find them.
So a lot of what this was, it was five one-shots. It wasn't a story that went through book to book to book. And some of it was, like, let's see, I think number five, Grimjack, Dread Star, and Nexus by Mike Barron and drawn by Luke McDonald. So good. Such a good book. Badger and Luther Ironheart, who was a character in American Flag, was a good one shot.
Joe Stanton art in there. Oof. And yeah. Our good buddy Angel Medina had a role in number two. Well, here, I got the list right here. Number
Which
one
was John Saber and Badger.
Yeah. Number one was Sable Whisper by Stephen Grant, Cynthia Martin. Number two, Sable, Badger, Mike Barron, Angel Medina, Rod Willingham. Number three is Badger, Luther Ironheart, like you said, Roger Salek, Joe Stanton. Number four, Grimjack Judah with Roger Salek and Sean McManus. And number five, and I seem to recall four went into five more tight, Grimjack, Nexus, Dreadstar with Mike Barron and Luke McDonald. Not expensive books at all. I mean, these are dollar bins. If you can find them there. I mean, I'm looking, I see a lot of copies for a buck and under. Good reading, though. Definitely better than, I know my copies have not split like the Total Eclipse. But as far as did it help increase sales for First?
Well, again, I was at Schindler's at the time. It sold to people who were already buying Nexus, Badger, Dreadstar, and Grimjack.
Yeah.
And this was around the time when First regular sales were dropping. And I believe this is when they went to the Prestige format miniseries for all their books soon after this. Because the regular series sales had dropped to the point where they did this. Oh, these make more money. So we're going to do that instead. That way, yeah, you know, we sell 10,000 copies of a comic that's $225. We don't make enough profit to make it worth the while. But if we sell 10,000 copies of a $395 book, then we do make enough profit to make it worthwhile. I enjoyed them, but I don't know how they hold up, because some of them, like Grimjack and Judah Maccabee. Grimjack hasn't been in print for 30 years. Judah Maccabee was a supporting character in Nexus. Are people even going to know who they are? Same for Badger and Luther Arkwright. American Flag's been out of print for over 30 years. Is anybody going to know who Luther Arkwright is? Whisper and Ooh. Sable. I love John Sable. I love Whisper. No one knows those characters now.
There's one on eBay for $9.91 without shipping. So you can find out for yourself fairly cheap.
And in some ways, First did have kind of their own universe with that Cynosure thing. Most of the books kind of were out on their own, but Grimjack crossed over into other things. Nexus of Badger, because they were both by Mike Baron, crossed over and over and over. Especially there was a 6-part story that led up to Nexus number 50 that Badger was in. That was just fantastic. I liked the first books. I thought they were one of the best publishers of the 80s. And if you see First Comics, the only one that I did, there were two that I didn't much care for. One was Dynamo Joe, which was a very 80s Americanized version of the Japanese giant robot stories. And the other was, what was the name of that? Metaphor. Great art by Ian Gibson, but the story made no sense whatsoever. Next, Future Comics, which every so often I remember. Oh, yeah, I remember them.
I do not. To me, this is something that, yeah, again, this came out 2002, 2003. I was not affiliated with a comic store. This, for whatever reason, did not tickle my fancy. And remember, I was still going through previews. I still do every month. So I really got nothing to say about this one other than it totally, you know, totally missed it.
I remember hearing about it. And while I like the creators, David Michelinie, Bob Layton, Dick Giordano was the editor in chief. Who else was involved? Bob Hall, Brett Breeding, Ron Lim. None of the characters seem interesting to me. And it was something where it was, okay, I will read it when it's on the shelf. And you no longer had a comic shop. Hot Comics did not get any of these for the shelf at all. I don't know if it's that Brian didn't like it or if it was, yeah, nobody's going to care. But he was not the only store that didn't order these because sales were pretty much dead across the board. See, it shows here that Death Mask number 3, Free Mind number 7, and Metallics number 6, all cover dated June 2003, were Future Comics' last publications in their initial run. The company's fourth title only appeared in a teaser. They've put out books now and then, but I think this was another case of, do we really need another superhero universe? And I like all these creators, but they weren't hot artists. I love Ron Lim. I'll buy whatever Ron Lim does. But Ron Lim does not drive sales. Bob Layton doesn't drive sales. It felt very much like a, all right, we were selling books in the 80s. We should be able to sell them now. And it's another of the things that I tell a lot of people on Facebook. And it's easy to tell when an artist doesn't know the market at all. I had somebody today who was, well, I got my book rejected from Image a second time. I'll show them. And I asked, well, did they give you any advice? Did they let you know what they didn't like? Did they let you know what to improve? And we're going to talk about more of that later. But he said, no, they just said that they weren't looking at superheroes at this time. And, you know, Image made their bones on superheroes. And I replied with, it's probably for the best, because time has shown that for superheroes, if it's not for Marvel and DC, nobody cares. Oh, you're wrong. Okay. I think this was another case of superheroes that seem pretty much like second tier Marvel and DC characters. Well, if I want to get second tier Marvel and DC characters, I'll go to second tier Marvel and DC characters. Anything else on Future Comics, Joe?
Nothing.
Kirbyverse.
I got to admit, I bought Kirbyverse. I did not read a single one of them. And they've all disappeared from my collection over time. So I tried to support it. Now, you can tell me, did I miss out by not reading it? And should I go dig them out of the bins and redo it?
This was, the origin of this was that Topps wanted to do comics. And they had some successful ones. Their Zorro book was successful. The X-Files book was very successful. They made a boatload of money off that.
I think they did Hercules and Xena as well.
Yep, they did Hercules. They did Xena. They had a number of tie-in books. They had movie tie-in books. But they wanted to do a superhero universe because in 1993, everybody had a superhero universe. So what they did, they went to Jack Kirby, who had some designs because he had tons and tons and tons of characters that he'd created either for starting comic lines or when he was working at Ruby Spears or when he was working at Marvel Animation. He was just creating characters all the time. Ruby Spears literally just paid him to create characters. And if any of them, Thundar the Barbarian, oh, we got a series out of it. Cool. That paid his salary for like years. So these were characters that he had created. Editor Jim Shalishrup, I think is how it's pronounced, put it together and got a bunch of people who'd worked at Marvel in the 60s and 70s. He had Roy Thomas, Kurt Busiek, Gary Conway, Gary Friedrich, Tony Isabella, artists Dick Ayers, Steve Ditko, Keith Giffen, Don Heck, John Severin, Walt Simonson. It says Kirby himself. Kirby didn't create anything new for these books other than maybe a cover or so, because by this point he had a lot of trouble seeing. He'd had a stroke. His art had suffered. And it was going to be okay. Secret City Saga is where it's all going to come out of. You will then have Captain Glory, Bombastic, Night Glider, and Satan's, what is it, Satan 6?
Yeah.
Is that what it was called? Satan 6. They are okay. Oh, DN Agents. No, Teen Agents, because he had done DN Agents, but Mark Evanier had already used that name, so he changed them to Teen Agents. And they came out on the market, and these are creators who were hot in the 60s and 70s. It's 20, 30 years later. Nobody is picking up a Dick Ayers comic in the direct market. Nobody is picking up a Don Heck comic in the direct market. I thought that they were well done, kind of second tier Marvel 70s books. Were they great? No. Were they fun ideas that somebody could have got a lot of mileage out of? Oh, yeah. I would say if you're somebody who wants to kind of wallow in some Marvel nostalgia for the Silver Age, these are going to hit that right on the nose. But they seemed, when they came out, they seemed out of date. Especially at a time when Image was, you know, with its kinetic artwork, and Marvel was doing the same thing, and DC was moving into more adult stuff. These felt like old comics when they hit the stands. And I think that's kind of why they failed. This was the time of the hot artist. Don Heck's a lot of things, but he's not a hard artist. John Severin, hell of an artist. You show his work to a 14-year-old in 1993, he's going to go, that's old.
That's old.
Topps closed it pretty quickly when it didn't take off. They did a revamp of it over at
Dynamite.
And I picked all those up on one of our runs, on one of those runs around the Twin Cities earlier this year. I have not read them yet. And Joe, you could probably speak to how they sold because you were running a shop at the time. And I remember they did next to nothing for you.
Yeah. No, there were people interested. And other than that, no. And, yeah, you know, usually I gave them a shot. I mean, I say they didn't sell, but I would always put one or two on the shelf. So, and when they died into the 50 cent pin. And I, again, I bought them all for myself. I don't know where they went over time. Probably in a box.
In a box somewhere. And our last one for this time are characters that have been revived more often than I've made a pizza at home on my lunch break.
And they actually go all the way back into the 40s. 1940s, that is.
Yep. Let's see, 1943 for some of them. No, 1939, Joe.
Ooh.
Blue Ribbon Comics number one. The Mighty Crusaders, which was Archie Comics before it was Archie Comics, when they still sold, you know, they still had other characters and stuff. The Mighty Crusaders were, let's see here, the Black Hood, Hangman, Captain Flag, the Shield. Who else in the earliest days? The Shield was a very popular character. Shield was actually a patriotic hero before Captain America. He had a shield. The old-fashioned shield that Captain America had in his first couple of appearances in MLJ, which then became Archie. They also were known as Red Circle. Sent them a cease and desist, which is why Captain America's shield became round. They said, hey, 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 your patriotic hero is too much like our patriotic hero, and you've got the same shield, so quit it! So they lasted through the 40s, and it looks like the last publication of the original characters was 1948. None of these characters were huge successes. The Black Hood lasted quite a while. The Shield is the one who lasted the longest. Steel Sterling was more of a mystery man than a superhero. But eventually, Archie took over the whole company. Archie was kind of, was a one of the stories in Pep Comics. And it was based on Bob Montana's teenage years. And it became really popular to the point where in the 40s, there was a radio show. Was there an Archie movie back then? I don't think there was.
I don't think there was.
The radio show.
Yeah.
And the radio show is kind of forgotten, which is weird because it was very popular at the time. But by the 50s, they were pretty much just publishing Archie, and they changed their name from Red Circle, MLJ, to Archie Comics. Then in the early 60s, they revived their superheroes. And Joe, does Joe know who was the man behind the revival?
I would say I don't know.
Joe Simon.
Oh, so it was a Joe. Trick question.
It was Joe Simon. Now, he wasn't getting paid enough for him to bring on Jack Kirby, although Kirby did do a little work for them, including some character designs. But Kirby was getting all the work he could handle for Marvel in 1959. And Simon had pretty much struck out on his own. There are rumors that when Simon and Kirby dissolved their partnership, it was for financial purposes. But there are a number of different stories, so we'll never know the truth because everyone involved has passed, that Kirby was upset that Joe Simon had kind of, okay, well, comics are dead. I'm leaving. Good luck. Rather than working with Kirby as he moved into magazines and then back into comics. But Joe Simon was the one behind when they brought them back in the 50s. And he treated it rather seriously until the Batman TV show. Then when the Batman TV show hit, they actually put out a couple of books reprinting some of these stories as High Camp Heroes. The Fly became Flyman. the Mighty Crusaders got really goofy. The stories now, you read them now, and they're just, they're so hard to read because they're, it's one of those things like if a guy in his 50s, me, tried to write something using the humor that kids had without understanding it at all. It would be like me trying to make TikTok videos that appeal to 15 and 16 year olds. Hey, fellow kids, the Batman series did raised all superhero sales until the Batman series died. And when the Batman series died, they crashed hard. Most of these were dead by 67.
The only and one the funny I remember thing is, having of this,
if you look at the Shield, comic Shield, which was Mighty Comics, boy, that Shield logo looks familiar, don't it, Joe?
Oh, yeah. The only one I remember buying, or I, for some reason acquired, I had a copy of The Double Life of Private Strong, number one. And it obviously sold because I don't have it now, but it was just one of those anomalies. Like, what am I? Oh, I also had Mighty Comics number 40, which was formerly Flyman. So it's just, you know, I look at these and go, I remember having this. Judging by the price, I wish I had it now, but they were just, you know, bits and things that you were like, what the deuce am I going to do with this? Now, the third universe.
Mighty Crusaders.
This one I was on because I remember my comic shop guy at the time telling me, oh, yeah, these are going to be fun. And I remember buying these. Let's see. And it was just, it was under Red Circle.
Yes.
Some of them. Later on, they put the Archie Adventure series scrawl, but by then, I don't think anybody cared, and they were dying off anyways.
Well, by then, what it was in 1984, they pretty much kind of passed. The experiment had kind of failed. So it's okay. The direct market doesn't want these books. So let's get them out on the newsstands with the Archie books, and we'll put Archie Adventure Comics. Because the Red Circle was Archie trying to bring back their superheroes in the direct market. And they brought in some name talent. Alex Toth did some Black Hood stories. Carmine Infantino did the Comet. You had Jim Steranko doing the covers for some of these books. You had Kirby do a couple covers. And... but they did not do well. And Archie also didn't give him much time. Let's see, Black Hood, you had an issue in June of 83, an issue in August of 83, an issue in October of 83, and then it was done.
Yeah, and see, that was the gap that killed it for me. Because by that time, you know, and again, this was my 12-year-old. Well, I wasn't 12, I was in high school. But, you know, if the comic disappeared, I just went on to something else. And even if it came back as Archie, I don't remember any of the Archie Adventure series because I don't know if my comic shop ordered them or maybe by that time I didn't care. But the ones that have Red Circle on, I do remember. I remember the Comet being pretty sweet. The Fly, I remember the Fly because of reprints in the Archie Digests. And what was funny about it was the Fly was married to a female version of the Fly, and I don't know what she was called, Flyette or something, but she was always mad at him because he thought she was mad because she didn't love him or appreciate him, and she was mad because she did that because she loved him and wanted him to stop being the Fly, so they had that drama going on, but that was reprints back in the second universe. They didn't really do it so much in this universe. They were more heroes. The one I remember very vividly, though, well, the Mighty Crusaders was fun, but it was the Shield. Because, not the original Shield, but the Shield, because they had a storyline, and again, it just kind of was done because they went three issues, and that was it. But the Shield was kind of an acronym out of time. You know, he was very much a patriotic guy and not really paying attention to the nuances of things. He ends up throwing a criminal through a window. And when the cops come, he goes, "Just doing my duty, sir." And as he walked away, and the cop said, "Oh, we have a problem here. This man is dead." And you're thinking, "Oh, sweet bejesus, they're going to bust this guy for killing the perp." And of course, no other issue ever appeared. But it's funny how to this day, that storyline was so unique. It wasn't done in Marvel or DC. And again, this is 83. I've been collecting since like 77. So the hero killed, granted, by accident, but he wasn't a deputy of the law. Again, a brilliant storyline that kind of went nowhere. Other than that, I don't really remember much. I mean, I remember liking the Comet. There was only two issues, and that was it. The Fly did a little better, had four issues. That was it. And this is before they came back with the Archie logo. Because, like I said, there was a couple months, and I'm pretty sure my guy, my comic shop guy, didn't even order them.
Yeah, you know, when they came back with the Archie logo, I remember flipping through them going, these don't look good. Rich Buckler did a lot of art for them. People who had kind of fallen out of favor with Jim Shooter and weren't able to get on at DC did art for them. But by the time it became the Archie Adventure series, the stories were made for kids. And I believe there was a toy line for the Mighty Crusaders at the time. Low-rent toy line.
Yeah, I ended up
only get at Kmart.
Well, I got mine on the discount rack because at the time, Children's Palace was in a death and struggle war with Toys R Us. And in our area, they actually moved in next to each other. And I ended up going and picking up them off the discount rack. Actually, I might have been a little bit later. But I do remember having almost the entire line. And they had zero play value, but they looked really cool for what the technology was at the time. So you'd think after three universes, they would give up, right?
Oh, no.
Oh, hell no.
Now, I know more of this, the fourth universe, because it was published by DC under the name Impact Comics. And I was working at Shinders when these came out. They didn't sell all that well, but I loved these books.
I totally ignored them.
Oh, you got to go pick them up. You've got
Mark Wade.
Because,
again,
this was right before you had your shop.
Yeah, and I have zero interest in them.
And
I recognized the characters. It wasn't like, oh, yeah. But to me, it was kind of like what you said. Oh, this is another universe. If they had interacted with the DC universe, I probably would have bought them. But I was not willing to like chuck down that much money for that many comics on something that just didn't tickle my funny bone.
This was a line that DC. Basically, Archie came to him and said, "Look, we can't do anything with this. Can you?" DC used it for two things. One, as books for younger readers, not as young as the Archie books were for, but these were for what we would call young adult readers now, 12 to 16. They used a lot of new talent. Paul Fricke did books. Len Strazewski did books. Mark Wade did books. This was where a lot of younger talent cut their teeth. Rick Burchett did books. Mike Paradek did books. And they were well-done superhero stories without a lot of continuity, without a lot of angst, without a lot of crazy, without everything tying in. Now, it did all build up to them getting together as the Mighty Crusaders in the book Crucible, and then the Mighty Crusaders and all the other books spun out of that. In a way, it felt a lot like early Marvel in that, okay, we've got all these individual characters. They're going to meet up as a team. Then we'll have our team book and the individual books. But the talent involved was so good. And you could read each issue on their own. However, it was from DC, but it was a separate imprint. They were aimed at a younger audience when DC was aiming more and more toward the 18-plus crowd with Vertigo coming into being and the superhero books going all grim and gritty. And I think the reason I liked it so much was these were not grim and gritty comics. These were not violence and blood, and they felt very much like 80s books. Well-crafted, well-put-together, fun. Yeah, if Mark Waid's involved in a superhero universe thing, it's going to be fun. And that's what these books were. The contract was for 2 years with an option to pick up, but the books didn't sell well enough, so at the end of the contract, they let the option go. They did do a Who's Who, three volumes that gave information on all the characters. And all of the books came to a conclusion because they knew, all right, our contract's up. They're not going to be renewing it. So there you go. But that's not all.
It isn't?
No. DC tried again. And this was in 2009. They put together another deal with Archie. These only lasted about a year and a half, though. I did not read these when they came out because there were so many comics coming out, and I was... And the other thing was, this was after the 2008-2009 recession, the Great Recession. So, hey, here's another line of comics. Do they tie in with the stuff that's already going? No. Well, then I don't have enough money to be buying more books. And they kind of came out and just kind of flopped. I picked them up recently because I was able to get the entire run in a $10 pack. The Crusaders, the Shield, the Web, all of them. But that's not all.
No.
Archie tried again right after, about a year or so after this ended. They did a, what was it? Super Teens versus the Crusaders to try and bring them back, the Crusaders.
Which I did buy because, you know, I'm a sucker for a crossover.
And they had a Black Hood series that lasted quite a long time. And if you look, it lasted from, let's see here, with the restart, 2015 to...
It's like 2017.
2017.
August.
Yeah. Dean Haspel has been doing a Fox series off and on for Archie ever since. And I think they just recently resolicited for another Fox miniseries. Also, when Archie started their Dark Circle books, they brought back the Hangman. They did a new Crusaders, but they haven't really taken off. And I believe some of them were digital only, and then they printed them later. So they were digital first and then printed. I have not read any of these because, again, it's, I don't know the creators. I don't trust Archie anymore when it comes to continued stories at all. Because I look at my Afterlife with Archie. I look at my Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. I look at my Archie series that kind of fizzled out. I don't need to read any more books that are going to have, oh, here's chapter 5 of 7. Bye. Don't know if they're ever coming back again.
Yeah, I think the last one they tried, they had Rob Liefeld on board until they kind of, in one...
Yeah, that completely
they decided. They kind of like, oh, you're giving away the surprise ending with the cover. I don't want to play with you guys anymore.
They've got some nice articles about the different times that they've revived it, including a long interview with Dean Haspel, who's been doing the Fox. Yet another company that, now the thing is, Archie, rather than going under, Archie just said, yeah, these aren't selling well enough. And we're just going to concentrate on what we do best. Now, our sponsor, concentrates on what they do best, and that is protect you while you're on the internet. That is NordVPN. Here's all you need to know. Our newest sponsor is NordVPN. Let's be honest, if you're out on the internet, you need a VPN to protect you. There's all sorts of things going on the internet where people can track you. You could accidentally download a keylogger, all sorts of things. NordVPN gives the best security possible. It has a password manager, which generates complex passwords, syncs across all your devices, stores your notes and credit card information. It also gives you 10 gigabytes of private cloud storage, secure files that backs up your data automatically. But the main thing it gives you is peace of mind. It gives you peace of mind when you're out on the internet, when you're streaming, when you're playing games, when you're listening to podcasts like this one. It gives you safety anywhere at any time. It protects your online activity. You get full access to all content. And if you use the link go.nordvpn.net/SH3KU, it'll take you to where you can get a great deal for a 1 month plan, a 2 year plan, a 1 year plan. They are our newest sponsor. We're happy to have them. And if you would like to sponsor something here at any of the podcasts on the Solitaire Rose Network, you can. Just email me, solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com. Thanks. And I also do what I know best. You know what that is, Joe?
Eat pie and Oogle Redheads?
And sleep.
Oh, sleep. What? No, you don't sleep.
Oh, that's right. I do all these podcasts.
Yeah.
The Solitaire Rose Podcast Network is filled with all kinds of audio goodness. First, there's Crazy Comics and Stories. It's been going since 2010. It drops every Monday, and it has me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard, and Joe Crazy Writer talking comics, shenanigans, and whatever we're freaking and geeking about. Every Monday morning. It's been going since 2010, and it's available at crazycomics.solitairerose.com. Also on that same feed is the Solitaire Rose Podcast, which is me, again, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard, doing interviews, talking about comics history, pretty much talking about whatever I want to talk about. We've also got Solo Joe, where Joe Crazy Writer does a solo podcast. And he hasn't done one in a while, so kick him in the shins to get him started. We also, on that same feed, have Solitaire Rose Series and Review, where we do DVD commentary of older comic book series. That's all at crazycomics.solitairerose.com. I also do a podcast with Wolfie B. Bad at badadvice.solitairerose.com, where we take listener questions and give them bad advice. There's also Novelcast, where I take the novels I've written and turn them into free audiobooks. That's at novels.solitairerose.com. There's also Fantastic Forecast, where myself and Adam Vermillion are going through the entire run of the Fantastic Four, four issues at a time. That's fantasticforecast.solitairerose.com. There are always more podcasts at the Solitaire Rose Podcast Network. Be there. Aloha. And now we get to what Joe does best.
Oh, yes.
No, not sneak over to my house and figure out how to get a new key.
Oh, that's easy.
No, it's what's going on the eBays, Joe.
Well, being that I haven't really talked in depth about what I've sold on the eBays, I figured we could go one of two ways, and I'll let you, the Strode, decide. I can either go off and we can list the different comics and variants and all sorts of fun, wacky things I've sold, such as a build your own Sears Tower set. This was like a big book with cardboard pieces in it, not cardboard, but, you know, the stiffer paper, and you pop it out and you could build a thing. All I do is I remember buying it and showing my manager at Sears that I think he was like the operating manager, and he's like, where are you getting these things from? Because, you know, I worked at Sears, so naturally I like collecting Sears things. Or I could talk about the several pieces of trivia I discovered that I don't think we've ever talked about.
Ooh, trivia, trivia.
All
trivia.
Right, let's do the trivia. All right.
Trivia.
And the first one, I will Ask the Strode. So go ahead, get yourself comfortable.
I don't even know where I keep my thinking grenades anymore.
Well, that's okay. Just make a booming noises. Corey, can you tell my good friends out there in podcasting land what the Mark Jewelers insert comics are?
Oh, in the comics that were sent to military bases or PXs, they would have a special insert that was almost a cardboard type thing in the center of the book that sold jewelry. So here you're reading the Fantastic Four, where the ads are for, you know, X-ray glasses and Venus flytraps, and in the middle, you can get a ring for your girlfriend for only $1,000.
Yep. And they were in Marvel and DC's. The comics, you can tell the comics because they will feel heavier and rigid. You can spot them from the top because you can see the actual insert. And, you know, if you Google it, you'll be able to see it. The key with these are is that these variants, unlike many other comic variants, they weren't subject to one comic company. Marvel, DC seem to have them primarily. And they don't know what the ratio of standard comics to the ones that have this insert in it. But you'd almost have to think the ones with this insert were produced in a smaller quantity, because like Corey said, they were distributed near U.S. military bases, both at home and abroad. So if you happen to be, and I remember having a few of these as a kid, because you'd be like, huh, this is interesting. I wonder why it's in this comic and not the other comic. And so I don't recall, you know, did I pick it off the newsstand this way? And by newsstand, I mean my friendly neighborhood comic store. Or was this just a back issue I picked up? And I was kind of like, oh, this is weird. So if you do run across this, you do have something unique, and you might have something rarer than the non-standard version. So, all right, Corey, you get a nice shiny dime. It's been a while since I've given you a dime, so enjoy it while you can. Okay, Corey, do you know?
I have a does Joe know?
Oh, a counter question. All right.
You asked about the Sears Tower. Well, you did ask. You talked about the Sears Tower.
Yeah.
What is the Sears Tower called now?
I used to know, but I don't.
You know why I know?
Did you visit it?
No.
Oh.
I work for the company it's named for, the Willis Tower.
Why, you bastard. I mean, good. Cool.
The office company I work for. So there you go. Now you can stalk me.
Nah.
Oh, wait, I've already got somebody doing that.
Yeah, you have enough stalkers. All right, Corey, tell me, do you remember Fudini the Great?
I've heard of Fudini the Great, but I never saw it.
Yeah, it was an early CBS television series for kids, a 15-minute puppet show performed at 6:30 p.m. Monday through Friday from 48 to 51, originally called Lucky Pup. But Fudini, the magician, and his assistant, Pinhead, proved to be so popular that they renamed the show. Not that that's ever happened before. I mention it because Fawcett, from 51 to 52, and if you recall, this ended in 51, published Pinhead and Fudini. Only four issues. Tremendously, well, not that really, expensive in terms of a back issue, if you can find it in any type of shape. I happen to found one beat to hell. It's on the eBays now if you want to look at it. But again, kind of interesting. Just this is what I love. And I get more about it when we get into geeking, because as I'm digging through bins, discovering this stuff, it's like, I think I bought this not knowing what it was. And I took it and read it. It was just a lot of fun to discover just an old golden age, almost on the brink of silver age comic, and then look up the history behind it. A little more, how would you say, current. Corey, do you recall Buck Rogers in the 25th century?
Yes.
So that, of course, is a very famous character. Good Lord, when did it first come out? Added them back
TV
in the
TV show?
Well, there was a TV show, a radio show, might have been some movies.
Well, there was a novel back in 1935, I believe.
Okay.
So, that it was all based on.
Yep. Well, in 1964, Gold Key came out with a number one issue. 1979, they came out with number two. And Corey probably knows why.
The TV show slash, well, there was a movie where they basically just took the pilot and put it in movie theaters.
Yeah. So that's quite a, we thought Miss Mystic had a hell of a delay. So you got number one back in 1964. And again, this is just the Gold Key Whitman run. There had been runs before that, which I'm not going to talk about today. Now, what's interesting is when you get to the number two and through number six, you can find them in both Gold Key and the Whitman variants. And the Whitman variants seem to have a higher price because they were probably part of the three packs that we all, us kids growing up in the 70s, used to destroy, trying to figure out what is that middle comic. With issue number seven, the series just had the Whitman imprint. And it lasted all the way through issue number 16. With issue 14, you got a yellow Whitman variant logo and a white Whitman variant logo. The white ones seem to be the ones that are rarer. And then issue 16 in 1982, it was done. All these were done. Well, let's see. The early ones, Paul Newman, Al McWilliams. Later ones, B.S. Walton, Mike Roy. So if you're a Buck Rogers fan, there's all you need to know about the Gold Key Whitman Buck Rogers. And finally, Corey, do you remember William Boyd, the actor?
Yes.
And why is that?
I know the name.
He says it's a Western.
I don't know.
He was.
I just know the name.
Yeah, he was known for playing the cowboy hero Hopalong Cassidy.
Oh, that's right. I've never seen Hopalong Cassidy, but Don McGregor, writer Don McGregor, who I'm close friends with, loves Hopalong Cassidy and talks about it all the time.
And when Boyd got a hold of Hopalong Cassidy, the original character was written by Clarence E. Mulford for pulp magazines. He was a hard-drinking, rough-living, red-headed wrangler. And then Boyd, who did not smoke, swear, or drink alcohol, his drink of choice being sarsaparilla, changed him into the cowboy hero that we all think about, who always let the bad guys start the fight. Now, Boyd, there was a Hopalong Cassidy comic, and it was from Fawcett. It started in 43 and went all the way up to 53. Just trying to see about 85 issues in all. And then it went over to DC. Photo covers and stuff. Bill, through Fawcett, did his own comic series where he starred as himself, kind of spinning off his most famous alter ego of Hopalong Cassidy. To differentiate this from the Hoppy title, Boyd was given a different horse, Midnight instead of Topper. But issuing a Western comic under Hoppy's real name wasn't nearly as successful as the parent title. The title lasted 2 years, came out with 23 issues from 1950 to 1952. Typical cowboy stuff, photo covers, just a lot of rain. So you got 2 years for Bill Boyd Westerns compared to 16 years rain for Hopalong Cassidy, where it was published by both Fawcett and DC Comics. And again, why did I discover all this? I happened to find a Bill Boyd Western comic. And this is the type of things I absolutely love about digging through. It's in beat to hell shape. It's a readable. Actually, the Bill Boyd might be in a little bit better shape than the previous Pinhead and Fedoni. But, you know, I read these. I loved them. They're on the eBays if you're interested. They may not be there by the time this drops, because I know, like, I think last time I talked about U.S. Fighting Force, and that comic sold instantly because these are just harder to find comics in any shape. Like I said, I'm willing to collect any shape, especially if I can just sit down and read it. And that gives me something to talk about on this here podcast.
Are you ready for the weird part about Hopalong Cassidy? because yes. you mentioned it, and I looked it up. When the movie series kind of was winding down, the producer wanted to make more ambitious epics and abandon Hopalong Cassidy because the B-Western was fading out. William Boyd, on the other hand, probably smarter than anybody else in the business at the time, asked if he could buy the rights to Hopalong Cassidy. The producer, Harry Pop Sherman, said sure, sold him the rights and the rights to all the movies. Boyd made 12 more Hopalong Cassidy movies and then sold them to TV, where they ran and ran and ran and made him a star all over again. He had, he had sold or mortgaged everything he owned to meet Sherman's price of $350,000 for the rights in the film catalog. He then brought a print of one of his older pictures to the local NBC television station, offered it for a nominal rental, hoping for new exposure. The film was received so well, NBC asked for more. Within months, Boyd released the entire library to the national network. They became extremely popular and began the long-running genre of Westerns on television. This made him the first national TV star. He was able to sell merchandise such as Hopalong Cassidy watches, trash cans, dishes, tops, trading cards. He was able to get a comic strip in the newspapers, which was where the money was, and a new Hopalong Cassidy radio show, which ran from 1948 to 1952. Boyd appears as Hopalong Cassidy for Thanksgiving in 1950. He led the Carousel Parade in North Carolina, which drew an estimated crowd of 500,000 people. He eventually started the U.S. television office to handle the legacy of Hopalong Cassidy. The company continues to hold full rights to the Cassidy name, trademark, films, and television masters. So there were a lot of people at the time who looked at the movies that Hollywood had, you know, for B movies, a lot of the B movies were just, okay, they've played the circuit, who cares? That's why you hear how, I think it's like 80% of all silent movies are gone, and at least half of the movies made before 1945 no longer exist. Because it was very much, okay, this is a B movie, it ran in all the theaters, it kind of did okay, oh well. It's never going to get used again. But there were some people who took them and said, hey, we convert this so that they could show it on TV. TV has, you know, TV needs content. Even when I was a kid in the 70s, they were still running the Ma and Pa Kettle movies. They were still running the Blondie movies. They were still running those old movie series, those B movie series that by then had completely faded away. The Bowery Boys. Oh my God, I hated the Bowery Boys, but it was on all the time. So there were a lot of people who just said, you know, I'm going to keep this. And the one that made the most money. Joe, what was the abandoned film series that has made the most money in TV reruns? Now, it's not the Three Stooges, because the Three Stooges had not been abandoned. The Three Stooges were still going in the 50s.
Was it Our Gang?
Yep.
Oh, I got one right.
The Our Gang shorts, which had been retitled The Little Rascals. They got formatted into a half-hour show and ran and ran and ran and ran and ran and made the Hal Roach Studios a fortune. Now, the Three Stooges made a fortune as well, but they were still making Three Stooges shorts, and by the late 50s, they were making movies. By the way, all of which are awful. Anything else, Joe?
Nope. I'm always putting stuff on eBay. Like I said, I was homesick, just sick at home, not, you know. But if you want to see what's up and you are a listener to this here podcast, let me know, because I might give you a discount, or I might just reach over into this incredible area of my vast accumulation of crap and just give you something. But, you know, you got to buy to do it. Crazy, K-R-A-Y-Z, come get some.
And now we get to my favorite part of the show.
Fire drill.
No, not where I start reading aloud from Eerie's Terror Tales, which I talked about last time, which I'm sorry, I still love what Wandana Land wrote on the back here. When Eerie Publications hit the scene in the mid-60s, they hit upon an interesting idea for writing their horror stories. They just wouldn't do it. Why pay writers, they apparently thought, when there were so many great horror stories that were already out there? I have been reading these. They are wonderfully terrible. And it's easy to tell. Like, there are some of them where it's okay. On the splash page, they added blood in a story that is completely bloodless. So I've been reading these at night. You know, when I'm getting ready for bed, it reminds me there was NEC. New England Comics had Tales Too Terrible to Tell. And then Craig Yeo has reprinted a bunch of horror comics as well. There's just something about those 50s horror comics during the horror boom where it was anybody who could hold a pencil. Yeah, draw a horror comic. Put a vampire in it. No, it's Freaking a Geeky Joe. What are you freaking on?
Well, I know you don't care, Corey, but the Thor trailer dropped. And I'm telling you, you can tell every whiny bitch ass white boy who hasn't read comics is bitching. And this is a spoiler in case you're going to watch the movie dry. Because there's a brief shot of a very buff Natalie Portman catching the hammer. Oh my God, Thor's a woman. Why is Thor going to be a woman? Oh, and the wave of whiny white fanboys crying out because their beloved Thor is now a woman obviously betrays the fact that these assholes have never, and I mean ever, read the comic book. You know, and I've complained about that in the past. You know, we have one guy who, you know, oh, I can't believe Thor's a woman. I said, you really don't read comic books. She hasn't been a woman, Thor, in, what's it been, 10 years now? I don't know.
That, yeah.
Yeah, it's been a long freaking time. So, again, I just step back, let the little boys have their crying fit, and well, that's geeking. So we'll wait and revisit that in geeking. That's pretty much all that's been freaking me out other than unexpected sickness. Corey, what's got you freaked out?
I got a few things. I talked earlier about somebody who said, you know, I submitted to Image and they rejected me a second time. And there are a lot of people who on Facebook and other social media talk about wanting to be comics creators. And for me, it is incredibly easy to see who's going to make it and who's not. The people who are going to make it are the ones who I sat down with this publisher or this editor or this person, and they gave me pointers and they gave me tips, and I'm really going to work on this so that my submissions are better. Those are people who are going to make it. They see it as a job, and they see it as, okay, I had an audition. I'm not good enough yet, but I can be good enough. Then there are people who... these idiots don't know good work when they see it. My stuff is better than what they're publishing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like I said with the person I spoke, I was trading messages with today. The publisher told you they're not publishing superheroes. Well, I'm going to keep, they used to publish superheroes, so I'm going to keep sending them superheroes. Eventually, they'll see how good I am. In book publishing, one of my favorite Twitters to follow is for Hard Case Crime. I've talked about Hard Case Crime a lot. They are a specialty publisher. They publish 1 to 2 books a month. They publish a specific type of book. They publish hard-boiled crime and detective. And they get submissions all the time for vampire romance and everything but. And the editor will say, I sent a letter back telling them, this is not what we publish. If you do have anything that fits our guidelines, please let us know. And more often than not, they'll either resubmit the book without making any changes, or he will get a letter or an email saying, but this is so good, you can't pass it up. When you are submitting stuff to a publisher, to somebody who is going to publish what you do in order to make money, it has to fit in with what they do. Marvel is not going to publish a 12-part erotic comic. They just aren't. DC is not going to publish a cutesy kid book featuring bunnies and rabbit, bunnies and chickens. It's not what they do. If a publisher or an editor actually takes the time to say, if you do this, you have a better chance of getting published, you should shut up, sit down, and be under the learning tree. If you don't, if you push back, you immediately go on their shit list. And you don't want to be on a publisher's shit list, because even if you do improve, they're going to go, yeah, this works better. Bad attitude. Can't work with an editor. Can't work with others. Don't hire them. You could be Neil Adams style level art, but if you've got a reputation with an editor that you're hard to work with, dude, you're just breaking in. They'll put up with Neil Adams being hard to work with because he's got 50 years in the business. You're not in the business yet. They don't want your headache. And then the sour grapes factor. I didn't want to be published by them anyway. Comics are a small industry. They're a speck on the publishing area. And even with book publishers, they're going to monitor stuff. If I sent a manuscript to at Signet Publishing and they rejected it. Well, they weren't a good publisher anyway. You think your name's ever going to be brought up well by people at Signet Publishing? If you badmouth DC, if you're out on YouTube talking about how, oh, DC and their woke comics, or Marvel only publishing women, you think an editor, when they get your package, oh, here's a pitch. I just put his name into Google, and he's put out 25 different videos about how our company sucks. Round file. If you're looking at comics as a career, if you're looking at writing as a career, if you're looking at anything as a career, you don't badmouth the people working in that field. It's the most childish, stupid thing you can do. And it's the easiest way. I'm not going to say you get back blacklisted. I'm just going to say they go, yeah, I remember you. You were a pain in the ass. The other thing, I love me my AEW. I do. I love my All Elite Wrestling. But lately, people have been bleeding on every show. There was a rampage with Wheeler Yuta versus Jon Moxley, where I don't know if he just didn't know how to cut himself properly or what, but he bled so much that even 5 minutes into the match, blood is pouring down his face and pooling on the mat. On this week's Rampage, both guys got busted open. And what they do when they're busted open, I actually was watching the show when it happened, and the person I was with at the group home said, oh, well, that's not fake blood. That's fake blood. And I said, no, it's not. What they do, they have a razor blade. And when the camera's not on and they're hunched over, they take that razor blade and they slice their forehead open. And it will bleed a lot, and the blood will mix with the sweat so that it looks like it's even more. And the blood there, because it's from capillaries, is red, bright red. And that's how they do it. You look at somebody like Ric Flair. You look at somebody like Abdullah the Butcher. You look at somebody like Dusty Rhodes, even somebody like Triple H. You'll see they have all sorts of scars on their forehead because they've cut themselves. We don't need that on weekly television. We don't need that every week. There were times in the past where blood was a part of wrestling. I remember in the 70s as a kid, every wrestling magazine, the wrestler had blood all over him. Yeah, they're wearing the crimson mask. The Crusher busted open by Nick Bockwinkel. But we know how it's done now. We don't need to do it anymore. I watched the New Japan show over WrestleMania weekend. Nobody bled. You will not tell me that any of the guys in that weren't working hard. They weren't working stiff. We don't do blood. Why? Because we don't need to cut ourselves open to tell a story. It's time for blood in wrestling to stop. If somebody gets busted open the hard way, you know, they take a punch wrong or they take a fall wrong and they get cut, that's one thing. But for people to slice themselves open just so the match has a little more drama, those days are over and it needs to stop. Even I'm a nobody, but I am sick of it, and I'm complaining about it every time I cover this stuff. And if I'm sick of it, you know other people are sick of it. So I really, really wish that they would just stop with all the blood. Joe, what are you geeking on?
I'm geeking on all sorts of stuff. Every so often I like to mention, you know, I the phone games that I'm playing, just in case you're playing with them, or if you're playing them, you can play along with me. I got three that I've stuck with. Everything else has kind of dropped. Wild Frontier, which is kind of a Western type game. I'm very happy I was able to get Simpsons Tapped Out up and running again. And I talked about that before. And I'm playing one called Switchcraft, which is one of those match three games, but it's not so impossibly hard, where I finally hit a level. And again, they have hard levels. Matter of fact, they have super hard levels, but it's not hard in a point where I busting my head on it trying to get past and a week later and I haven't done anything. Because, you know, you got to pass the levels to get whatever you need to keep the story going. So if you're playing those games, come on in, invite me, whatever. I mentioned the Thor trailer. Loved it. A couple weeks ago, people were like, they haven't done anything for the Thor trailer. They even remember it's coming out. Yes, they did. It hit almost everybody I know that's at least a comic fan has heard about it. People who weren't like, hey, have you seen this? Yes, I have. Very exciting. And other than the people crying and freaking, I can't wait. It's going to, you know, between Doctor Strange and Marvel, just take my money. Speaking of taking money, we've talked about a friend of mine. He does a podcast called Cinema Judge. Just Google Cinema Judge. Pick your favorite place you want to download podcasts. He did an interview with some of the actors from Moon Knight, Oscar Isaac, Ethan Hawke, and Callum Away. Am I saying that right? And Kevin Fergie, the guy who's masterminding all this. So they talk about the series Moon Knight. He has movie clips, behind the scenes footage, all sorts of fun stuff. So if you're not quite sure you want to watch it, you can download his podcast, listen along. You be the cinema judge if it's worth watching or not. He also has all sorts of other things. So if there's a movie coming up and he's reviewed it, he just dropped one, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, with Nick Cage and why can't I think of that guy's? Oh, the Mandalorian guy. Well, he knows who he is. Anyways, Cinnamon Judge, check it out. As you know, and as I mentioned earlier, the MCBF MicroCon is coming up Saturday, May 14th. And in order to help, I told Kelly and the boys, hand me the flyers. I am dropping them off at every shop I can in the Twin Cities. I'm going to be mailing them off to shops that I can't get to. I've so far hit Issues Needed in Apple Valley, Mind's Eye in Burnsville, Cedar Cliff in Eagan, Hot Comics Richfield. The owner was kind enough to take flyers for me to the other store up in Minneapolis. Comic College, Dreamhaven Books, Heroic Goods and Games, Nostalgia Zone, which is open. I texted Corey quickly because I actually went in there and dropped $50 on some trade paperbacks, which was fun. Time Bomb and Wizard Wax, which are next to Nostalgia Zone. I got there just as they were closing. I did not realize I'd been doing it for over 8 hours, but the owners graciously took some flyers and said they'd pass it out. I know Granite City and St. Cloud has them. The Source Comic and Games is covered. I'm going to hit places like Rock Hopper, Nerding Out, and then I got to hit all the littler shops that have popped up, and I'll be talking about it. The reason I mention it is because I dropped a lot of money, and I picked up a lot of fun stuff. For example, down at the Issues Needed, I found a $10 copy of Remember Corey Batman from the 30s to the 70s. This was a coverless book, black and white. I remember renting these out at the library, the Superman one, the Shazam one. I've had them off and on in my collection, but just for $10, I picked it up. It's cheap. I picked up a copy of World's Finest Guardians of Earth, which has some of Superman's greatest team-ups. See on the back, we got a couple races with Flash. There's Robin, Batman, Aquaman, what was it when she had her note? She didn't have her powers, Wonder Woman. Did we say the Donna Reed Wonder Woman? I don't remember.
No, I don't
remember. Emma Peel.
Yeah, Emma Peel. It was like Emma Peel.
Let's see something. I picked up a set of Elektra Assassin. There was that DV8 box set that came out, and inside it had a bunch of unique comics, a certificate of authenticity, and of course an autographed card that was really cool. Got that from Steve Brown at Cedar Cliff. Steve got in a lot of really cool collector rare variants, as well as his normal accumulation of stuff. So it's always fun to stop by and see him. Again, these are things I'm going to read. If I don't like them, I'll put them on. I've picked up a copy of Sax and Violins by Peter David and George Perez. Another trivia book, trivia question. Corey, did you remember X-Men the movie, the exclusive Toys R Us, a special movie prequel edition that they gave away at Toys R Us?
Yes.
At ToysRUs.com?
Yes.
Did you know what the other version was? Same comic, different cover. In the X-Men trading card game, they had an X-Men trading card game box set. Inside the box set was the exclusive comic, same comic, different cover. The reason I know that is because Comic College has one. I was going to pick it up, but I got so excited digging through the $3 bins, I forgot to pick it up. So if you're smart, you'll get there before me and pick it up. Let's see some other things I picked up. A book from my childhood. I picked this up from Heroic Goods and Games. Walt Disney Showcase, The Jungle Book. The complete picture of the Walt Disney feature movie, which I don't believe I've ever seen The Jungle Book, where I sat down and watched it. I know I got it on videotape for the kids, and of course it's streaming. But this was just one of those things I picked up and read, which was a lot of fun. So, yeah, I got all sorts of things I'm going to be going through. I'll read them. If I don't like them, I'll go on eBay's. Speaking of reading, and you thought I didn't, I actually read a couple things. The first one, I picked up a copy of Captain Marvel Annual number one, just because it was a done in one. And she is with the Star Jammers. And I'm kind of on a Star Jammers kick because it was in the latest issue of Back Issue, where they talked about some of the star characters in the 70s. And it was good. This is what the annual should be if they're not going to be a big continue-out series, just a oversized fun edition. I had to get a little confused towards the ending because I was like, where did the Star Jammers go? Oh, there they are. They're way in the background. But it was fun. I also picked up and read Star Trek Spock Reflections, a 4-issue series from IDW. Basically, an aged Spock is traveling back to Earth. And while he's on a transport being talked to by a very talkative Star Trek alien, he's reflecting on events ranging from his youth to his time with Pike to his time with Kirk. This is one of those Star Trek series that plays to fanboys like me who absolutely love it. And I got to admit, by the time that I did not know what Spock was up to, by the time the first issue came, I got to say, what he did, I was genuinely touched. It makes me, I didn't quite tear up, but it was one of those, oh, that's so cool. So kudos to the, and I'm going to rip open issue one and just talk about who the creators were. It's one of these series, Scott and David Tippin. I'm not sure if the art stayed the same, but number one was David Messina. This is one of those series that, you know, kind of reminds me of watching Picard, which is streaming and loving. I'm loving it on Paramount. Is that, you know, when you reach back and you give a shout out to, or just a, it could be an Easter egg or it could be something fun for long-term fans. Like, Corey, you remember the scene on, and again, spoilers for those of you who haven't seen Picard. You remember the scene on Star Trek 4 when they were hunting whales, where they were sitting on the bus and the one rock and roller is playing the music super loud and, excuse me, can you turn it down? And he flips them off and Spock reaches over and gives him the neck pinch. Fast forward 25 years to the character, 7 of 9, and one of the characters that's unique to the show, I think her name's Real. They sit down and this guy's playing rock and roll music super loud, punked out, and Seven's like, excuse me, could you turn that down? Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I didn't mean the exact same actor.
And absolutely. It's the guy who's been working on Star Trek for a long time.
I know. Absolutely brilliant. And when I saw that, I'm like, no. And as soon as I'm done, I go to trekculture.com where they dissect the show. And yes, it was really him. The last episode, they had a thing where some of the action occurs in a bar with a band and a singer. Guess who the singer was? Patrick Stewart's wife.
Oh, okay. Yes, I did read that.
And the guy who does the Trek Culture got called off. He said, I cannot believe I missed that. Because, you know, they do the big thing and it's all flashy and showy. And they, because they're working with Paramount, they get to intersperse actual scenes from the show. Well, this was just a cut in and he's leaning into the camera. I can't believe I got yelled at for missing this. And I'm finally, I mentioned it last week and I'm going to mention it again. I'm very, very proud of my wife. She retired. By the time this podcast drops, she'll be having her first week. I'll be doing my first week with her. Maybe a freaking in that because she's got her designs on helping me reorganize this vast accumulation of crap. Could be fun. Could be messy. Oh, well. So lots of geeking going on. Corey, what are you geeking on?
One of the people I work with at the group home is very cool. I like them a lot. They're fun to work with. We talk writing all the time. They are currently in a class about comics, and they had to go over Mouse. And we talked about Mouse, talked about how Art Spiegelman's an asshole.
Although, like I said, in the beginning when he was hungry, he was very kind to me when I did a radio interview with him.
Yes.
Curse the gods at the radio station because they didn't record it. Or they tried to and it failed, but that's a different subject. Greg Ketter remembers it. I'm sure Art doesn't.
But one of the parts of the class is that they had to draw a comic page. And they showed it to me. And I said, do you want me to appreciate it or do you want me to criticize it? And they said, could you please criticize it? Because everyone I'm showing it to just says how great it is. So we sat down, had it on a tablet, and I talked about how on the page, I don't know what panel to look at next. There was no iFlow. I then got other comics and showed how artists move your eye across the page. Now, Joe, what artists would I use for demonstrating that?
Kirby.
Kirby's the master at it.
Yep.
So I just, and I literally just said, okay, I'm going to pull up a random Kirby page of Marvel Universe, the Marvel Unlimited. All right. You see how he does this? See how he does this? See how this works? Yes, it's a six-panel grid. You're doing something more experimental. Here's a more experimental page, how he does that. Here, and they really appreciated that I went through and I didn't just go, oh, that's really good. And instead, I didn't go, well, that sucks. I went, here's how you can improve it. And first off, I'm kind of happy that I know this stuff. Because for, you know, most people, when they read comics, they just read comics. But I like to think of myself as a critic. And a critic doesn't mean you tear stuff apart. It means you understand things more than a layman. So you can explain why something works, why something doesn't work. It's why I always liked Roger Ebert. Roger Ebert was a critic. He had spent his life learning about movies, learning how they worked. And it wasn't, oh, this movie sucks because I didn't like it. He would say, here's what's good about it. Here's what's bad about it. Here's why it ultimately doesn't work. Joe, you've got that DVD of Citizen Kane. On that DVD, Roger Ebert does commentary and talks about it in detail. You listen to that, you've taken an entire semester of a film class because he tells you everything about how a movie is visually put together. And the thing that was best about it was, you know, we talk a lot about writing process. And it's good to have people that you can talk process with when you're creative. Because a lot of times, if you show your stuff to your friends, they're just going to go, oh, that's really good. They're not going to tell you, your second act has some problems. You introduce a couple plot lines here that you don't finish up. And your ending just kind of was a grand finale. Your ending was a grand finally rather than a grand finale. So it's good to have people like that in your life. And I'm glad I'm able to be that for someone, but also that this person is that for me when they're able to say, where did this character come from? You didn't introduce this character. This person seems very two-dimensional. You need people like that to kind of help you get better. And it's a wonderful thing when someone helps you get better. And I really wanted to point that out, especially with podcasting, because I've had some people like Peter Rios in the early days, or some of our fans in the early days who said, I like this, I don't like this. They've really helped us shape this into a podcast that I think people really enjoy. Comic-wise, I only read two major books. The rest have been, like I said, I'm reading crap because it's fun to read crap. And I don't mind reading crap. There are times you read crap because you just want to turn your brain off and read crap. The novel I'm reading right now is crap. It's well-written crap, but it's crap. And 2 months from now, I won't remember it at all. So the good stuff I've read. I read The Seeds, which is by Anne Nesenti and David Aja. 2 issues came out, and then the pandemic happened, so they just completed it in a trade paperback. It is set in the future, where humanity is divided by a wall. On one side of the wall, there is no technology. On the other side of the wall, everybody's deeply involved in all technology because something horrible happened with the bees. And when the bees weren't around anymore, the food wasn't around anymore. So, et cetera, et cetera. David Aja's art is so beautiful and so wonderful at telling a story. I can see why people who read, you know, your standard superhero stuff or your standard comic would look at and go, what? But as he showed on Hawkeye, as he showed on other stuff, he's able to tell stories by the visuals. And I loved this book. Ann Nocenti's always been someone who deals in this sort of thing, very political storytelling that has the political base and then the characters come out of that. Loved The Seeds. Absolutely loved The Seeds. The second book is one that I talked about last week a little bit, and that is Brian Michael Bendis's Pearl, which is one he did with Michael Gatos, the person he did Alias with. It is a crime story set in California with the Yakuza. Pearl starts as an assassin. And the thing about it is Michael Gatos, again, very unconventional storytelling, uses a lot of photo reference. Not conventional at all. It does take a little while to get into that headspace. Bendis is great at a crime story, but there's one criticism I have, and that is he has a kind of a supernatural, superhero-y element in the book. And by the end of it, I wish he wouldn't have had it because the story worked without it. And by the end, it was really clear. He was like, yeah, this was bad. I didn't need to put this in the book. And he's kind of shoving it to the background. But other than that, a really good book. And I'm glad I waited until he was done, because as I went through and looked, okay, when did this come out? It was one of those where, okay, Sade Issues came out, and then a long gap for the 9th, and then a long gap for the 10th, and then the 11th and 12th came out when the contract ended. And I understand Bendis takes on too much and has trouble with deadlines on his creator-owned stuff, because the stuff he does for Marvel or DC or whoever takes precedent because it makes a lot more money, and contractually he has to meet those deadlines, whereas creator-owned stuff, but it's his. He can be late. But it's why I don't buy his stuff until it's completely done. Believe it or not, kids, you've listened to us blather on about funny books for an hour and a half.
Thank you very much.
And as we say every week, the comic we like the least, we still like better than the comic that you like the most. Joe?
My sickness is your gain, Corey, because I don't care to do a dad joke today. Instead,
oh, goodness,
just hit my music.
Done, bitches!